Back in the 1980s, in Section G of the New Orleans Criminal District Court, everybody smoked. Section G was Judge Frank Shea's courtroom, and when you talk to lawyers who practiced in front of him during that time, or defendants who were sentenced by him, it's one of the first things they will tell you. Everybody smoked. The prosecutors, defense attorneys, the court reporter, the minute clerks, the jury, and Judge Frank Shea himself. Here's Gary Wainwright, who worked as a public defender back then.
On each one of the counsel tables was one of the big ashtrays from like the 50s. So each counsel table had a giant ashtray. He had a giant ashtray on the bench, and he had affixed to the 14 jurors' chairs in his courtroom airliner ashtrays. So it wasn't unusual when you opened the door to the courtroom. It was worse than a bar room.
It's as if the smoking can explain something about Shea's courtroom and the criminal justice system back then that is otherwise difficult or too uncomfortable to articulate. Today, of course, it is acknowledged that smoking's bad for you. But back then, everyone was doing it. From The Lens, I'm Nick Krastel, and this is the Section G Podcast, looking back at the controversial career of Judge Frank Shea in the New Orleans Criminal District Court during the rise of mass incarceration. A few months ago, I reported a story that detailed the case of Aaron Hunter, who was accused of killing a man named Greggy Jones in 1987 out in New Orleans East. In 1988, he was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Hunter's conviction was based on the testimony of a single eyewitness and the fact that a gun found in his house matched the bullets used to kill Greggy Jones. But when investigators took a close look at the evidence years later, there were a number of things that called into question the validity of that conviction. For instance, Hunter was in the business of buying and selling stolen property, and the gun was one of many that was taken from his residence. The lead detective on the case would later go to federal prison on an extortion charge. And when the single eyewitness, Vanessa Causey, testified before the grand jury, she told them, "Even though I didn't see him fire the shots, it was in my heart, you know, that he did it. And I got on my knees and I asked God. I said, well, if he's not the person who did it, remove these feelings from my heart, you know? And those feelings haven't been removed, and I knew God would have answered my prayers because I have faith and trust in him." The grand jury went on to indict Hunter, and he was eventually convicted. Lawyers on appeal and investigators with the Innocence Project would later contend that the detective used the fact that the gun was found at Hunter's house to pressure the witness to change her story in order to secure Hunter's conviction. Even the prosecutor on the case, a woman named Lori White, who is now a judge herself, would later cast doubt on Hunter's guilt. In a letter she wrote to the Innocence Project, she noted that Vanessa Causey was of dubious character and that Hunter's lawyer was a walkover, to say the least. "I would be very interested to free a person who was wrongfully convicted," she wrote, "especially if I was the convictor." But back in 1988, if your only knowledge of the case was what was presented at trial, say, if you were a member of the jury, those nuances might have been lost on you. Can you talk about the trial?
Sure.
The little trial that we did.
That was from an interview I did with Hunter last September at Louisiana State Penitentiary, a few weeks before he died of a heart attack. Hunter's trial, the one that would determine the course of his life, took place in a single morning. It was held in the smoke-filled courtroom of Judge Frank Shea. Shea, at that point, was well into his decades-long judicial career. He had been elected in 1963, promising to reform the criminal court bench and resist political influence. But by the time Hunter appeared in front of him, he had become well entrenched in the system, and he had been serving as chief judge since 1982. His career spanned 33 years, until he retired 2 years before his death in 1998. At his trial, Hunter's testimony on his own behalf lasted less than 10 minutes. He had more to say in his defense, but his lawyer didn't ask the right questions to get the full story out. Then, during cross-examination, he tried again to get his story to be heard by the jury. At that point, Judge Shea ordered him removed from the witness stand. The story that Hunter was trying to tell was that police had initially come to his house not because they suspected him of murder, but because he was in possession of a stolen television.
Well, I wanted to tell them how it actually happened. Mm-hmm. How to come to my house looking for stolen property. How to arrest me with guns and television set and everything else. You know, and then I didn't know nothing about the crime. I couldn't tell them about the crime because I never knew nothing about the crime. Mm-hmm. You know, but how I get implicated in it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what I wanted to tell them.
Instead, Shay ordered Hunter removed from the stand. Shut up, Shay told him. You already testified. Now be quiet and let your lawyer represent you. As I began to look into Hunter's case, one of the questions that I asked myself was how a murder trial, in which someone faced life in prison, could finish in a single morning. One factor, Hunter told me, was the failed representation he had received from his lawyer, John Dolan.
Dolan wasn't interested in my case at all. I don't think he was interested in anybody's case. Just wanted to do the job and, you know, get it over with.
Following his conviction, appeals courts repeatedly agreed with Hunter's assessment and ruled that he had received ineffective assistance of counsel. They found that Dolan failed in his pretrial investigation into the murder weapon, failed in his cross-examination of the state's only eyewitness, and failed when he did not allow Hunter to provide a full testimony during trial. But the more compelling answer to how a trial could last just a single morning was Judge Frank Shay himself. Shay built his whole career on moving trials along as fast as possible. In 1975, Shay held almost a third as many jury trials as all the judges in Louisiana outside of Orleans Parish combined. In 1976, the Louisiana State Legislature passed a resolution commending Shay for conducting speedy criminal trials by, quote, silencing long-winded redundant attorneys. The resolution also suggested that Shay was an excellent model for other judges and lawyers in the state of Louisiana to bring about an interest in developing a more efficient method of disposing of criminal cases. In 1985, he held 6 felony trials in a single day. So, Hunter's trial was not an anomaly. But what did it say about the criminal justice system that the speed of a trial was the measure by which judges were evaluated? That Shay himself seemed to value speed above all else? That holding trials in record time was not questioned, but celebrated? What did it mean for defendants like Hunter, who were sentenced in front of Shay? And what does Judge Shay's popularity and longevity tell us about his particular era in the criminal district court, at a time when the country as a whole, and Louisiana in particular, were locking people up at a rate never seen before? Over the next few weeks, the Section G podcast will be talking with attorneys, judges, and defendants who knew the late Judge Frank Shay. Some respected him, some hated him, some had their freedom taken by him.
The Section G podcast is made possible by community support. Show your support today at thelensnola.org/donate.